This podcast features a session from the EDUCAUSE 2011 annual conference. The session is by Malcolm Reed, JISC Executive Secretary, and is entitled Open Resources, the Need for Integration.
Essentially, what I'm going to try and argue is that to date, the various open agendas have been tackled in a rather discreet manner by different groups of enthusiasts. The arguments behind them can be rather different. I'm not suggesting that there's some necessarily common intellectual underpinning behind behind each of these debates. But I am going to argue that an institution should consider openness as an actual policy rather than consider, say, open access or open data or open educational resources as a set of individual items. I'm making this argument from a rather pro-open attitude, but I'm not suggesting that I'm not suggesting that institutions should only debate it if they're in favour of it. I think it's a policy issue that institutions should debate seriously and consider in relation to a number of issues that I will expand on. And I think that that debate is important. If they then conclude that in some or all areas the open agenda is not in their best interests, well, so be it. I don't feel that the open movement needs every body to participate. You just, for instance, simply just don't need thousands of pieces of course material about simple harmonic motion or something like that. We just need, I would argue, a core of materials. In the open access area, perhaps there are more serious issues for society and the world as a whole. So I'll start off by giving some of the benefits of open access, not necessarily just in terms of the benefits to institutions. I've then got a couple of slides that list, as it were, examples of institutions that have fairly advanced policies from across the world. There's quite a number. I've finally got a few slides on work that we've been doing in the JISC over a number of years and that we plan to take forward. I'm not entirely sure there'll be time to cover those. But in general, there's a lot of references in my slides to other projects, other pieces of work. And you'll have to go to the online copy to find further explanatory notes and, in particular, web links, because otherwise my slides would look a bit cluttered up if they were full of web links. You see that I've headed this slide, the open agenda. I'm struggling to find some sort of portmanteau term to encompass the idea of openness at the institutional level. But one of the advantages, of course, of being in America is I can put a challenge to you because Americans are enormously good at enhancing the English language with new words. So here is a challenge. There are other slightly more peripheral areas of openness, incidentally, which I won't have time to cover, but I'll mention now just to perhaps give a flavour that the debate and the scope is perhaps richer than some people think. There are questions about open research databases, by which I mean databases of researchers and their skills. These are known as CRISP systems, Current Research Information Systems. A lot of debate about whether they should be open. There's information, there's ideas about open metadata, open bibliographies and so forth. I won't be going into that kind of detail, but I do think it's important to realise that there is much more to the open agenda than just these sort of headline issues of open access in the research domain and open educational resources in the learning and teaching domain. You'll also have to excuse me if I turn around because my eyesight has reached exactly that point where I can't read the screen in front of me. And at that point where I can't be bothered to wear glasses because they're a nuisance, and in any case, Although they'd make me look more professorial, wouldn't they? So it's not a vanity thing. So the benefits I'll cover under these headings. But I think the debate in an institution is going to depend rather crucially about the attitude and the mission of that institution and their general approach to IPR. And the extent to which they feel that the knowledge they have should be freely transmitted to society and the world. And many institutions, of course, will fill that, not just the so-called open universities, but a lot of universities that have rather strong links to their local and regional agendas and to business transfer and so forth. But, of course, I'm well aware that there are other universities who feel that IPR is part of their competitive edge. I will try and argue that that is maybe not always the case. So, first of all, a couple of examples from the open access domain. Open access is, I would argue, largely one in an intellectual sense, by no means one in an operational sense. A debate that is predicated by quite a simple thesis, which most people would hold up as perhaps even a self-evident truth, and that is that the outputs of publicly funded research should be made publicly available. Well, I've got one supporter, good. And actually, that I think that simple message quite often gets lost, and it gets lost because of a heated debate with the publishers that are based on economics, not really based on the principle of benefiting society through publicly funded research. I think that's unfortunate. I think that's inevitable. I think that will also massively slow up the take-up of open access in a way that perhaps many of us would wish. I'm not going to expand on those arguments. You're either already an expert in that case, in which case it would be tedious to go through it again, or you're probably on a different side of engaged in a different set of activities. But I have got two examples that I think are quite good, and they're examples that are, you know, typical of probably hundreds and thousands of examples out there, if only we could perhaps collate them together. This company, White Design, has set up to building materials out of straw, a component which has a very low carbon footprint in its manufacture, and also a component that actually traps carbon for the longer term. They managed to find through open access the academic papers and so forth that underpin their business model. So they've suddenly got a robust body of scientific evidence to support their whole product. That's worth an awful lot of money to them. That's a new industry, or a new company, perhaps a new industry able to start up. Exactly, I would argue, what proponents of open access are hoping for. Next example is a little more technical. It's to do with the ability to text mine, and the same argument holds true for data mining. The amount of this one's from the genome world, but it applies in pretty much all of the more popular sciences, where the body of information is frankly getting too large for any one academic to actually be able to scan the material. Increasingly, one is having to rely on computers simply to scan the papers and the other research outputs necessary to keep up to date. Without open access, that cannot be done. Unless you work at an institution that can afford to pay the licenses for access to a very, very large number of publishers, you will not be able to trawl all the papers in your discipline. Through text mining tools and applications. There is, interestingly, an attempt certainly in the UK, to try and get the copyright laws changed to allow fair access to include the ability to text mine through resources in such a way that the publishers could not stop that happening. Well, whether that gets passed into legislation, I guess, remains to be seen. But at the moment, the inability to do that, I would argue, is going to massively constrain a lot of the modern research and future research potential. Moving on to another line of benefits, the one that it enables institutions to move faster and more flexibly. Here we have actually, if you like, the grandfather of the open movement, I think, the open source movement, certainly one that's been around for some decades, one that remains very popular, one that it was an early proof that society will collaborate in terms of exchanging information in an intellectual basis. A movement, of course, that's taken a huge increase with through social media and activities such as Wikipedia. I think it's a rather a life-affirming movement. It's something that we as human beings can feel really rather proud about. I think that there is this spirit of helping people. It does, of course, also expose the rather large proportion of nutcases there are out there. But one would hope within the academic domain, but in the academic domain, we would hope for more serious and intellectually rigorous activities. That's a particular example of one application from the University of Kent, designed more to help students. It does prompt me to say that the interesting thing about reading lists, certainly at institutions I know about, is that increasingly lecturers are only putting online and open access material on the reading list. This is because students are reluctant, for the most part, these days to go to the library, quite apart from the fact that they might well find the materials not in the library, even if they did go there. They are getting, indolent, I guess. They're looking at the library as a learning space somewhere nice and quiet. They're not really thinking about it quite so much in terms of the place to find materials. They want it online, they demand it online, and lecturers are responding to that. Now, an interesting thought that I put to you here is that it shouldn't then become too difficult for online material relevant that the lecturer identifies as relevant for the course that he or she is teaching could actually be streamed together and available as a print-on-demand type document. In other words, a tailored sort of a textbook made up entirely of open resources. That's an application that really shouldn't be too difficult to achieve. This report I'd particularly commend to you if you're interested in the open educational resources. Our program has now been running for some 3 years. We've been putting public funding into universities, not for the creation of open educational resources, but to stimulate more structured approaches to putting things together at the institutional level, to stimulate policy discussions at the institutional level, and also to produce software to promote interoperability and so forth, because there's another growing recognition that large pockets, or even small pockets, of open educational resources sitting in isolation is a resource that's underutilized. If you can get metadata such that you can link open educational resources across the world, certainly those in English at any rate, then there's clearly a huge benefit to both the teacher in terms of finding out what material is already out there and the student. The advantage to teachers, of course, is that they don't have to produce an awful lot of course material if suitable material already exists and can be brought together. I personally have my doubts about that at the university level. I think most university lecturers would feel it is part of their unwritten contract with the student to produce course material that exactly reflects their approach. I guess I'd be interested to know whether other people feel that that might be a cultural issue that is, that is quite strong. But of course, the students, they're much more promiscuous, if you like, in their willingness to take material from elsewhere. And there are examples you'll find in that report and in other places that will be listed in my talk of real benefits to students. Essentially, if they can't understand the lecture they just attended, if of course they did attend the lecture, if they can't understand that, chances are that somewhere else is a set of material that more exactly fits their way of thinking and can enrich their education. This one's in the open research data area. Now, this is perhaps one of the more recent areas of the open agenda in terms of popularity, as it were. It's much more recently being discussed and considered. And much more difficult in some ways. Open access journal articles, the cost to an institution, for instance, of making available the papers written by their staff, is not high. I mean, technically it's not difficult, and it's not high to spin that much information. When it comes to research data, the cost can be very high indeed. Not just high in terms of spinning the data and making it available, that's probably fairly modest, but very high in terms of the work that a researcher would have to put in preparing the metadata to describe the data set that they're making available. A whole set of a spreadsheet of a whole set of columns of data mean nothing unless the environment in which the data was collected or the experiment carried out is very tuneful. You must tell me what it is so I don't make the mistake of getting it. So anyway, back to open research data. So I don't think I would advocate a generic openness for research data. I don't think the research community could afford the cost. And I think in many areas it's not at all clear that the data needs to be widely available. There's also quite complicated issues, of course, about making data available that could then be misused. There's certainly ethical issues, of course, about, say, healthcare data. I think we rule those out of the consideration immediately. But data can be reused, could be reused badly. It also perhaps removes the researcher's competitive edge for a period. There are, of course, some disciplines where data has always being kept for the longer term, not necessarily open. I'm thinking of environmental data. You clearly can't go and repeat an earthquake. You must capture the data and keep it. Also in the social sciences, an awful lot of so-called longitudinal data, long-time series of data, which must be kept. But we are finding evidence, and there's a report that you'll find listed that we did jointly with an organisation called the Research Information Network in the UK, which has attempted to find and identify the benefits, the efficiency gains to the research community in terms of making data more openly available. Quite a lot of issues, incidentally, about how you find data. A Google search is not really designed to help you find sets of data. And that's another area we're doing quite a bit of work on. Only one slide on open access and the economic debate, again, because I particularly want to point you, as the notes behind this slide do, to a whole series of studies that have been done by John Houghton. First of all, he looked into the cost-benefit issues, the benefit-cost issues. BCR here stands for benefit-cost ratio. He's from Australia, so I guess they always turn things upside down there. He first of all did this study in terms of the benefits of open access in Australia. We then asked him to do a similar study in the UK. Other countries such as Germany and Denmark have done it. I mean, this is a guy who's really got it made, hasn't he? He could sort of move around the world, really, just doing global edits, I'd have thought, on his paper. But that's unfair, actually. He does a very thorough job. He is an economist, so you can't quite understand what he's talking about, but that's quite separate. You'll see, however, that all the different models of open access, I won't go through them because, by God, are they tedious, but there are a lot of different models to the way you can produce open access, and they all show a positive benefit-cost ratio. In the case of the gold open access, a huge error bar, as it were, so one has to be a bit careful there. But I think you'll find the report of real interest if you haven't come across it, and if you're interested in the economic arguments around open access. I'm a little sceptical, really, about it, because this kind of debate assumes a mass open access movement, essentially that all material will become available through open access. And whilst I would dearly like that to be the case, whilst I actually think that should be the case, it is perhaps a long way off and maybe never will happen. Now, proving quality is obviously one of those benefits that an institution will care an awful lot about. A research-led university often advertises itself to students in terms of the research-led learning or the research-led teaching experience. And I think that has real meaning. I think many of us would actually know what is meant by that. The extent to which that happens depends crucially, I think, on the teaching abilities of the researchers, which, as I guess we all know, is somewhat variable. In the most inspiring lectures I went to at university were when researchers spoke about their actual research and could relate the subject to what they were doing. What I'm arguing here is that can we find some way of tying together open educational resources more closely with the research that underpins it, to put some real meaning behind this concept of research-led learning. I'm not saying how that can be done, because I'm not a teacher and I'm no longer a researcher, but I put that challenge, if you like, out there as well. A more straightforward example here of the Royal Society of Chemistry making a lot of its chemical structures available. Quite a simple one to follow up, but of a huge benefit to the research community. I haven't got a slide on this, but whilst we're on the topic of improving quality in the open educational resources area, one of the strong arguments we've used to encourage this is, of course, that improves the quality of the course material no end. A lecturer might not produce the very best course material if it's still the same material that they used to run off a Ronio or Banda sheet back in the 70s, kind of stuff that I saw as a student. I'm sure it's still plenty of it out there. We do find that many lecturers give all sorts of imaginative reasons for why they wouldn't wish to put their material up in the open domain. And we do find that it usually comes down to the fact that their material really isn't very good. And I think it's certainly in an environment such as the UK where we're about to charge students anything up to £9,000 a year, which might not appear a lot by some American standards, but it's a massive change in the UK, then clearly the quality of teaching to the students is going to have to improve very considerably. And open access can encourage that to happen. There's nothing actually like peer pressure to improve quality. Which actually then brings me on to the last of the benefits I'm looking at here, which is institutional reputation. When I made the argument for the funding to the funding bodies, and we've had funding of about £5 million a year to support open educational resources for the past 3 years. It was marketing that I particularly stressed. The fact that open educational resources markets the individual lecturer and should in turn, I'm not saying it will necessarily, but should in turn provide recognition and reward to the lecturer because it is a clear example of their ability as a teacher. It has enormous potential benefit to market the institution. It also does a lot more to tell a student about what kind of educational experience they can expect doing that subject at that institution, which I think is an area that perhaps we're not too good at. Universities are really very good at telling students what kind of sports facilities they're going to have, how many pubs there are within walking distance. These are important. They'd be important to me anyway. Not the sporting facilities, I'm too old for that. But the they're less good, I would argue, at about telling a student what kind of educational experience they can expect in university. They don't even necessarily get across the point of view that, you know, they're not compelled and forced to produce material and to learn in the way that they would have been at schools, which I mean K-12. That change in educational experience is not always brought out, and that has to be a reason for some of the dropout that happens in universities. I know from, this is only a sample of two, but I think that's two more than most policymakers use, so I'm quite pleased about it. My daughter, for instance, went and did history at York many years ago, and she was amazed and delighted to discover that there was actually the process of historiography and proper historical research, because up to that point history had largely been the retelling of interesting stories with a bit of a context behind it. She was delighted to discover that there was a whole academic and intellectually rigorous approach behind history. Another young lady I know did history at another university and was horrified to discover that it wasn't the retelling of interesting stories, and she dropped out and went and did art or something like that. And that is a failure, I would argue, of the universities, that they're not making it clear what is expected of the student in an academic and intellectual sense before they apply. Open education resources can do that. Nothing to do with this example, but never mind. Now, a particularly embarrassing example here, the University of East Anglia, the so-called Climate Gate scandal, which I guess you would have heard about, where their email system was hacked, a piece of clear industrial espionage, I suspect, and a number of emails about lost data and not making data available were exposed in an attempt to undermine climate change research ahead of the Copenhagen summit. Really quite damaging. Really quite helpful, though, to those of us who are interested in pushing the open research debate. It has led to a couple of parliamentary inquiries in the UK that are now pressing for open data. And in my conversations with them, I've actually been trying to scale it back a bit because, you know, they're saying, well, all research data should be openly available, and I'm arguing, as I did a little earlier, that probably the research community could not afford to do that, and in any case it would make a lot of data available that really didn't need to be, that would never be used again. They're also, incidentally, as the final parenthesis there shows, asking questions about whether the source code that researchers write to do their research should also be openly available. I won't expand on that, but I think you can see that there'd be quite interesting policy issues around that. I think this is my last slide on quality issues. It's an example of the studies that MIT have done. MIT, of course, was pretty much the first institution at an institutional level to make a lot of open educational resources available. In the UK, the other biggest collection of open resources is the Open Universities Open Learn collection. these are the benefits that MIT argue that they have seen, and they seem to me to be quite powerful. The Open University has also done similar work on the benefits from their open resources. They're finding similar benefits. They're finding very, very good follow-on from members of the public who look at the open educational resources and then go on and take a course at the Open University. The Open University is open, incidentally, in the sense that it's open to anyone. You can apply to do a degree there. You don't have to have a whole set of pre-entry qualifications. So it's open in that sense, a rather different meaning of open. And that's why, for instance, like the portmanteau term that I was arguing we should try and find can't be open university, because that's already taken with a rather different context. I'm coming to the end now, really, of what I've got to say, which leaves a fair bit of time for questions, which I certainly hope there will be. I've got a couple of slides here that list some of the more leading-edge institutions, policies in this area, but really they're still not quite what I'm asking for. They're still not umbrella policy statements about the extent to which a university should embrace the open agenda across the piece. In other words, we're a university where our resources are openly available. That is our ethos. That is our policy. And then these other kind of subsets of open activities can follow through from that. I don't think we're yet seeing that debate taking place. And I think we should. And certainly in the UK, the DISC is going to do its best to help promote that debate. There's a few more slides here. Notice at the bottom, Cape Town and some Australian universities are going a little further. They are talking about being an OER-type university, but even that, of course, is still not addressing openness in the research area. And then I think, for reasons of time, I won't go much further. Our experts in the open agenda are attempting to build an alphabet of open activities. It's jolly clever, but they're going to have to do a lot of work before you can get open source on that list, I'd have thought. You'll notice that open bibliography I didn't talk about, but that's about the sharing of library metadata, so that you've got a debate, actually, of course, that's been going on for a good 15 to 20 years, to my certain knowledge. Why on earth it hasn't happened, I'm not sure, although I can guess, knowing quite a number of librarians. But and then my last few slides, which, as I say, I won't now go through, but they do talk about the work we're doing, the work particularly that we're doing with the open movement to try and improve the engagement with businesses and the local community, where clearly there should be real benefits. A lot of more technical, a lot of policy and policy work, and if you like, proselytizing and encouraging the debate, and that means an awful lot of work with scholarly societies and research funders. I haven't spoken about mandates. Some research funders, most research funders, certainly in America, the National Institute of Health, of course, has taken the lead, mandate and say it's a condition of their research grant that any subsequent papers must be open. They're not always very well policed. In fact, they're mostly not very well policed, policy having been made. What I do find that works enormously well, or seems to work enormously well, is if there is an institutional mandate where they say, when you come up for tenure or for promotion, we're only going to look at those papers you produce that are sitting on our repository, that are reflecting benefit to the institution, reputational benefit, for instance. Now, that really works. That's certainly, you don't have to enforce that. That's self-motivating. We're also doing quite a lot of technical work on interoperability. Clearly, large collections of open resources that cannot be linked and simultaneously searched are not going to have a great deal of impact. So this this ability to interoperate and exchange information and get common standards across the world is a widely recognized need and quite a big challenge. But we're doing our bit to work on that. That comes down to a few more specific examples. You can follow all these up, as I say, if you look at the slides and the supporting notes on the website. We do have a national repository for open materials where we've been promoting open access. We've required them to deposit in a central repository. I'm not actually arguing that all open materials should be in central repositories, but as a stopgap measure, it's a useful technical way of tackling the problem. So I think I'll stop at that point, and I'm very happy to take questions. So thank you. Now, come on, don't be frightened. I don't bite. Oh.
Henry Schaefer, NC State University. I'm wondering how idealistic you are with respect to open data. There are a lot of practical reasons not to release data openly. For example, I've been involved in the past in genome data, and where the workable solution was the requirement to, as a precondition of publication, to have the data deposited in GenBank, which could be a matter of days, weeks, months, or even years at times.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I was trying not to give the impression I was being optimistic about open data. I think there are quite a lot of complex issues. I've certainly mentioned the cost of doing it as being a limiting factor. Where you've got national data banks, well, then I suppose the issue there is to discuss with the national data banks their approach to openness. I am much more concerned, actually, about publishers who insist on data that they might then demand the IPR behind data in the way, of course, they do behind the paper. That would be a price simply not worth paying, in my view.
Speaking of publishers, how do faculty handle the problem of publishers' copyright release agreements? If an institution has an open policy, an openness policy, a faculty member who wants to publish in a journal that requires copyright release is sort of in a bind. How is that handled typically?
Well, first of all, I would argue that an author should not hand that copyright over in the first place. If you strike that clause out of the agreement, and of course very few researchers will be brave enough to do that, they nearly always accept it, or at any rate will give you a license to make it openly available. What normally happens is that they demand some sort of exclusion period because they want to protect their revenue. They want to be there with the news first. Oh, incidentally, I should have started off by telling you that apparently they captured Colonel Gaddafi as of about now, I think, an hour and a half ago, because you might not have picked that up. God, I'd like to be first with the news. But back to your point, which I now think I've lost. Guys. They should not. The whole point about open access is that it should be done with some kind of license that leaves the author free to pursue open access. I think authors should be strong on that point. I think they should be backed up by their institution on that point. Maybe it's just going to be a battle of wills, but I think the principles are too important not to have that fight.
Good morning. My name is Cable Green. I'm the Director of Global Learning at Creative Commons. And I'm wondering if you'd talk a little bit more about open policies at government levels, the core idea that you got at where when public funds are used, that the works that are produced with those funds should be freely and openly available, but not just open and free, but openly licensed. So
yes.
Could you dive a little bit deeper into that? What might those policies look like in an ideal world? What would they look like?
Well, not many governments are yet brave enough to come up with policies here. Although our government certainly makes strong statements about open source and very much the argument you put. The point about what kind of licenses they're going to use is just frankly too difficult and too technical for policymakers at government level to engage in. I think that's an area where we, and I think Creative Commons, of course, is a massively important and valuable activity. It underpins almost everything I've spoken about. And if I have a concern about Creative Commons, it's longer-term financial sustainability, which seems to me to be something we should be concerned about. But it would be difficult to get legislators to go into that. They wouldn't have that degree of understanding at the moment. You do get MPs, ministers of parliament, and ministers grasping quite readily, though, the overall principle, and they do support it, and that does lead to the funding bodies mandating open access, and they will, of course, probably state how it's done. They probably need a bit more education about what kind of license to use, but obviously we promote Creative Commons. Oh, actually, I should have done that, shouldn't I, which gives you a bit of a plug. As if you need it. It's probably research funders and institutions, and I think it's institutions more than research funders. Most research funders, although interestingly not, I notice yet, the National Science Foundation, but most funders do mandate, they do not police. It isn't that they don't care so much, it's just rather difficult for them, because most papers come out after the research project has ended. In other words, you know, the file is closed as far as a funder is concerned, so it's difficult for them to follow up. I don't think that's quite answered your question. I'm being slightly evasive because, like most normal people, I don't really understand all the ins and outs of licenses and Creative Commons, and I'm now too old to do so.
Josh Barron, I'm currently serving as chair of the Sakai Foundation board, and one of the things I think we've seen in open source development over the last decade or two is the growth of kind of commercial ecosystems that grow up around those open source products. And I think we're starting to see maybe early evidence and things like flat wall knowledge around similar kinds of models happening around open content. So I was just wondering if you could speak to that a little bit, and if you think that's going to be a positive or negative.
Well, yeah, so something like Red Hat, for instance, in the Linux movement, those kind of companies that we were thinking of?
Yeah.
Well, I would have thought that was a rather good thing. In the UK, certainly in our further education sector, for instance, products like Blackboard are getting too expensive for them, and in some cases they want rather more, want to be able to tailor their learning management system a bit more. A healthy industry growing up and developing and promoting, for instance, Moodle, would actually, I think, be of enormous use. I know there are some activities in that area. I guess my answer is that I think that that's yet another benefit of the open movement. It stimulates whole new industries. Certainly, open publishing is stimulating open publishers as an industry in its own right, and a very an increasingly vibrant and welcome industry, which of course coming up with quite novel approaches. The PLOS system, for instance, has a very novel approach to peer review, stating that peer review should happen after the paper is published, and should be based on the rigorousness of the approach and not just the judgment of peers. So I'm not going to pursue that debate. You might have your own views, but it is the kind of thinking in the margins that open activities generate.
You can hear more podcasts by visiting us online at www.educause.edu/podcasts. Thanks for listening.